Hey folks, Weingart here. This is the MCRIP podcast. A month ago, we had part one of Avoiding Resuscitation Medication Errors with Brian Hayes, the Farm ER Tox Guy. Today, we have part two. Let's get right into it. All right, so let's talk about insulin drips. I don't think many people who aren't savvy nurses or pharmacologists understand this, and I don't quite understand the reasons for it. I just know it happens, but insulin actually binds to the plastic tubing of the IV, and you have to account for that when you're mixing up and setting up these infusions. So what is the proper way to do that?
So the old literature says that you need to flush the line with 30 to 50 cc's of your insulin infusion to, quote unquote, saturate the line before you're going to make sure that the patient's actually getting the dose that you want them to get. Now, I don't know how you mix your insulin bags, but our standard is 150 units of regular insulin and 150 cc's of normal saline. So it's basically a one unit per one cc infusion. And if I'm wasting 50 mLs of that, then that's like a third of my bag. And so I found some more recent literature that actually, it was a pretty neat study actually back in 2006 in Diabetes Technology and Therapeutics. I think we'll include this
in the show notes
list. But they found that you probably only need more like 20. And then there was an editorial that went along with that that said, yeah, the 20 is probably okay. And it's probably good to stick with that. But, you know, it's going to vary from depending on your concentration of insulin and all this other stuff. But 20 seems to be potentially a better number. And it's funny because I tweeted this out a couple of weeks ago just as a sort of a pearl. And I got some feedback from some ICU nurses in Australia, which is one of the reasons I love Twitter so much, within minutes. And they said, what is this? We don't do this. And so I talked to her about it a little bit. And they basically said that in Australia, a lot of them don't necessarily believe in this as much. And some of the ICUs don't actually do this. And then I talked to my ER nurses, and I think only some of them do it too. So I don't know if it's even necessarily standard of nursing care.
I don't think people know about this, but unless those nurses down under were actually, you know, head to head testing whether the patient's sugar was changing as quickly without the flush, then not believing in it seems like, you know, just putting your head in the sand.
Yeah, true. But this is a pretty neat study that we'll include and it's a short one too, just to look at. And they compared different volumes, and they found that 20 cc seemed to be a sufficient amount to, you know, properly prime the line.
All right. So folks, check out those articles and see what you're doing in your own ED. Let's move on to another drug, which we've really changed how we use it over the past couple decades, naloxone. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, there's a lot of thoughts on this, and I hear this whenever I go to my toxicology meetings. We have a lot of pretty premier toxicologists up near where you are at the New York Poison Center with Dr. Goldfrank and Dr. Lewis Nelson and Robert Hoffman. And there's a lot of thought now that maybe we shouldn't be giving these patients, you know, slamming in 0.4 or a milligram or 2 milligrams. I mean, I don't know how many times, you know, you get the patient that comes in from the medics, bring them in, and they're like, oh, we just slammed in 2 milligrams of IM naloxone with no response. And it's like, yeah, that's because it takes 4 to 5 minutes to work. And then all of a sudden the patient's puking and agitated and wanting to pull out their lines and leave. So this new approach is, well, why don't we, now this doesn't, this is, does not apply to your, you know, hairy code patients. If your patient's about to have a respiratory arrest, like definitely give them a good dose of naloxone, 0.4 or 1 or whatever you want to give. But this is your patient that has a little bit of maybe hypotension. They're CNS depressed. They're not ventilating how you'd like them to, but they're doing okay. Basically what we do is we do about tenfold less than the 0.4. So what I do is we take up the vials come as 0.4 milligrams in 1 ml. So we drop that 1 ml of Narcan or naloxone. We dilute it in 9 cc's of a saline flush. And basically now you have 0.04 milligrams for each ml that you have in that syringe. Label it, which we'll talk about in a little while. But then what you can do is you can basically give 1 or 2 ml at a time. And instead of going way past that wake-up dose and causing them to be in withdrawal, now you sort of really find the true wake-up dose and you don't overstimulate them. So you get them to a point where you're comfortable with where they're breathing, you find the right dose of naloxone for them, and then you are actually better set up to probably start an infusion if you need to later on down the road as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly what we do as well. You know, a little story, and, you know, I've never done this personally for the purpose of this podcast, but, you know, if you didn't like a hospital you were bringing a patient to as a medic, you just give a big, big dose of IM naloxone just before you hit the ED. You get them through triage, you get your butt out of there, and then you you chuckle in the bus at the panic and fun that will ensue when the reversal is done. But we would never do that, Brian, right?
Of course not.
No. Okay, good. Let's just make that clear. All right, so we've discussed naloxone. Let's talk about a drug that just has no place in the ED or critical care, to my mind, hydralazine.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, I don't know how you feel about it. We haven't talked about this yet, but I know that we have this issue where we have patients that'll hang out in the ED for a while. I'm sure you've heard of it, the whole boarding situation.
Oh, boarding? No, what's that?
Yeah, and so we have patients that are, you know, they're admitted to the internal medicine service or wherever, but they just don't have a bed upstairs. So they board in the ED for 12, 18 hours. And they came in hypertensive. They have a history of hypertension. That has nothing to do with why they're getting admitted. But the floor won't take the patient because they have their pressure is too high. So, oh, why don't we give them a dose of hydralazine just to get their pressure to a point where the nurses upstairs will take the patient. It's kind of like this battle. And then all of a sudden your patients, you know, you give a 10 milligram dose of IV hydralazine and the pressure drops 40 or 50 points, a lot more than you intended it to. And hydralazine is a great vasodilator. It's a good afterload reducer, but it's just erratic in the way that it lowers people's blood pressure. You and I could both get 10 milligrams and my blood pressure doesn't really drop much and yours drops a lot. And I don't have a good way to differentiate who's going to have a response to that or not.
Absolutely. I want drugs that have predictable and titratable response curves, and this one does not.
Absolutely not. And then if you're thinking about it to use it as an afterload reducer and say like your acute pulmonary edema patient's CHF, then you have to really worry about that reflex tachycardia that comes along with it, and you're going to be further stressing the heart when you don't want to. And so, I mean, there are a couple of potential indications for it, but I just think overall, I mean, the problem is like you see – you know, the patient gets admitted to neuro and PRN hydralazine and labetalol both kind of are part of their order set. And so they could potentially get this IV hydralazine up on the floor. And then, you know, you just worry about what might happen.
Absolutely. Nicardipine is my preferred neuro agent for blood pressure control. And it's also okay for the patients with preeclampsia. So the two reasons people tell me I need to still have hydralazine for me have disappeared.
Yeah, I agree. And I love nicardipine too. We use it in almost primarily in our especially our head cases.
Yep. All right, let's move away from specific drugs to other error techniques for actually giving medications. And one I wanted to speak about was the infusion dead space issue. You have a drug, a potentially life-saving drug like norepinephrine in a profoundly hypotensive patient, and you start the infusion and nothing's happening. One potential cause is infusion dead space. How do you folks deal with this issue?
So we basically prime the line before we put it on the patient. And I think what you're getting at is, so if I just hang the drug, there's going to be, and the rate is really low, then they may not actually get the drug for a while until it actually gets to the circulation. And so I don't know if it completely takes care of the problem, but we prime the line to the very end, till it's actually kind of dripping. And then we'll hook it up to their saline lock there or their line, their flowing line, and we'll start it from there. And it probably still takes a couple minutes before it's fully sort of going in, but I think that helps at least take care of the dead space issue.
So let's be clear here for the listeners. So if you take a patient with a saline lock, and oftentimes those have a third of a ml of actual dead space, yeah, no problem. You're good. Right. So that's not really where the issue starts. The issue starts when you have a patient who has a line, maybe they have a normal saline hanging, and they go to one of those medication ports and they put the infusion there. And now if that line is free flowing, it's going to flush in whatever's dripping into that med port. But if that line's turned off because you're done giving the patient volume, it has to go from that med port to the patient before it has any effect. Now, in normal lines, that's also not such a big deal because it's only a couple cc's to get from that med port to the patient. But sometimes you take these trauma lines from our trauma lines to go from the first infusion port to the patient is 6 cc's of fluid. And if you have a low infusion rate, it's going to take a long time before the patient gets any of that drug. So do you guys have any rules about, should you be putting these infusions into free flowing lines? Should they always be straight up to a saline lock? What do you guys have any take on this?
We don't have any rules on this, but now that we're talking about it, I think perhaps we probably should, especially with the drugs that are, like you said, that only may have a small volume infusing per hour, and may not even sort of reach the patient. So I'm going to go back and actually look at this and figure out which drugs we have that might meet this criteria, and maybe talk to our nursing management and see if we can come up with something.
Yeah, we have I don't know if it's written anywhere, but our deal is it's always going into a flowing line, or it's directly into the saline lock or the port of a central line without going into any other line, because that's where we've run into all our problems. Drugs like vasopressin in our hospital have a 4 cc an hour infusion rate. So you can imagine if you have one of these back ports, or, you know, sometimes they're using both ports on those lines, so there's a lot more dead space, or you put it into a cordis that has an 8 cc or 6 cc dead space before it actually hits the patient, they're not getting that drug.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about another tangential issue to the meds themselves, and that's how during a resuscitation, if you're going to mix up syringes, for instance, for intubation, for push-dose pressors, they need to be labeled. You never, ever, ever, ever would give a medication that's not being mixed and given immediately by the same person without a label on it. You'd never use an unlabeled syringe that someone else handed you. What is the safest way to label these syringes?
So I think that the safest way, I mean, you're not going to have a lot of time. You just want to write the basic information on here so that the person administering it knows exactly what the drug is and how much of it is in there. And so generic name absolutely has to be on there. And I like to add the dose as well, but you could also add the concentration. So, for example, succinylcholine 20 milligrams per ml, 120 milligrams. And that way, because a lot of times if someone might be mixing it, but you're giving it to someone else to actually administer, which is my role, so I'll mix up all the stuff and then I'll give it to a nurse to administer. And yeah, they might trust you, but they really want to make sure that what is in the syringe that they're giving is what it's supposed to be. And then I think of it too, like when you pre-prepare stuff for, say, your procedural sedations, you might be thinking about using ketamine and propofol together. And if you mix them in the same syringe, now it's just white and it looks just like propofol, but you got half of it filled with ketamine. So you got to just make sure that exactly the contents in there are known to anyone that walks up, and it's legible and it's good to go.
So we do it just slightly differently in that I have actually mandated, for whatever extent I can mandate things, that the dose never get written on the syringe, because this always concerns me. If the drug is one that you use a little bit, you give 3 cc's and then you put it down and now you pick it up again, now that dose on there is no longer accurate because you've used up some. And if you just leave it as generic name and concentration, then it is always accurate, because they will have to then look at how many cc's there are to find out how much is fully in the syringe. But that will remain accurate regardless of whether it's picked up and put down. And this is all emerging from the anesthesia world, where they've managed to make every single error you can about pre-mixing syringes, because that's what they do every day, thousands and thousands and thousands of times across the country. And they have their societies actually writing guidelines on this, and they say leave the dose off, because the way they use the drugs is they have emergency drugs. They'll give a little, you know, for instance, like a phenylephrine push dose, which all came from the operating room. If they gave 2 cc's and then another anesthesiologist took over the case and that had on it 200 micrograms, but there's only 8 cc's left, then it's not 200 micrograms anymore. It's not whatever you mixed it at. So it will always, always stay consistent if it's just generic name and concentration.
That's actually a really good point, and one that I hadn't thought of really. And I'm going to do that now too. That makes a lot of sense. And that way they'll know what's in there. They'll know the concentration, and you just have to do a quick calculation to know how many mLs you have really. And then that'll be your dose. I really like that. More doses for me.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to hear that, because now I'm getting verification that what I'm yelling at people about is actually makes some sense. Okay. The last thing I was going to discuss, I found this anesthesia article that discussed the top 10 drug error commandments, and the article itself is in the show notes. And most of them are relevant only to the anesthesiologist, but there were four of them here that I think are relevant to us in resuscitation. I want to hear your take. So the four are: never inject a drug from a non-labeled syringe, that we've just discussed. Never inject a drug you're not familiar with. Keep all empty vials until the end of the resuscitation. Very good idea, because if something bad does happen, you want to be able to trace what actually took place. And then whoever is the injector of the drug is responsible for it. They can't claim, oh, someone just handed it to me, so I gave it. What do you think?
I really like the third one. One example we already talked about. So keep all empty vials until you conclude the resuscitation. This includes I would even extend this to non-resuscitations, such as your TPA cases, because you always want to make sure you know exactly how much was given, how much was wasted. So I keep everything until it's all said and done. And then this also applies. We had a recent case, a very, very sad, a young girl with sickle cell disease that ended up succumbing to, we don't even really know exactly, but it was a little while after getting a dose of an antibiotic. And the thought afterwards was saying, well, do we still have the antibiotic? Because if we have a bad reaction to blood products, we can send it back to the blood bank and have them test it to make sure it was what it was supposed to be. And the truth is, we don't really have a process like that within the pharmacy world that I know of. But if something does happen and it's around the time you were given it, definitely keep it to make sure you can, as much as you can, try to make sure it was what it was supposed to be. There wasn't any recalls or whatever, just to make sure.
Definitely. And I would add one fifth commandment to this, which is if you can, when you hand someone a syringe that's marked up the way we just discussed, it's always nice if you have the vial next to it. And that allows one more final check that everything is as it should be. So generally what I like to have happen is if someone's handing me succinylcholine, they hand me the syringe that says succinylcholine 20 milligrams per ml. They have the empty vial next to it. I look at that. I've confirmed by looking at it, it is indeed succinylcholine. We only have one concentration, so I don't stress about that. But on drugs where multiple complications, for instance, the epinephrine we discussed, if they show you that little vial for the epinephrine you're asking to inject IV, maybe a push dose epinephrine, and they show you that they drew it up from the little vial, you know immediately just by looking, there has been a mistake here. Throw that all out. Let's start fresh.
I totally agree with that. And we rely a lot on technology these days, and a lot of our, you know, storage-based cabinets for our meds, whether it be Pyxis or Omnicell or whoever we use, a lot of them have scanning technology where, you know, you say you want the midazolam and then you have to scan it and it approves it for you. So we get into this habit of just relying on the technology and not actually looking at the vial itself necessarily until you're drawing it up as much as we should be. So this would be just another second double check to say, yep, this is the drug. I'm showing you the vial that I pulled in, and here's the syringe. And so I totally agree.
Brian, this has been fantastic. If folks wanted to read more of your stuff, where can they go?
So through Twitter, Dr. Michelle Lin out in San Francisco invited me to be part of her academic life and emergency medicine blog team. And so usually once or twice a month, I'll have a post on her blog, which is academiclifeandem.blogspot.com, I think.
Yeah, we'll put the link in the show notes. Okay. Michelle needs a better domain name.
We're switching.
Okay.
We're going to WordPress soon.
Beautiful. And then how do they find you on Twitter, which is you're totally worth following?
So on Twitter, I am at FarmERToxGuy.
There you go, FarmERToxGuy. It's the description's in the name. Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks so much for having me. This was really great.